I'm sorry, it's got all the elements, the ocean, the century, the sport, the sea, you know, it's just fantastic. And it's wonderful to see a recreational club engaged in this. David also asked for our help in terms of raising the profile with the council and the clerks and things like this, which we've written to them about. And so we'd like to continue that. Last year we had a joint meeting with the Elwood Angling Club celebrating their history. So I think it's a great thing that we're not in isolation, we're belonging to this club. And actually I'm trying to buy a sea kayak at the moment, but I can't work out what is what and which model we get and all that. So actually very that we're here, you know. You might have a second hand one down the story today. I'll just let David tell the rest of the story and the fantastic things the new club members have been doing.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. I'm just an ordinary member of the Victoria Sea Kayak Club. I'm not a president or on the committee or anything. I was volunteered by the committee to do this, and I was happy to do so because I've taken quite a bit of interest into this, in this who I think, and Meyer obviously agrees, is a fascinating ex-St Kilda resident of the 19th century. A gentleman by the name of the Reverend Frederick, wonderful name, Charles Bonfield Cherry, a real Victorian name, I'm sure you will agree. And our interest in this man is directly related to the fact that we are a sea kayak club, and we believe that your reverend is entitled to be known as the very first Victorian sea kayaker, and quite likely the very first Australian sea kayaker. So we think that alone it's worthwhile bringing something. But to move on and tell you a little bit about it, can you please? I'm just going to talk casually to some slides here today. I hope that's okay with you. I am not a researcher. I'm not involved in research at all. People have helped me do this. And so everything I've got here to show you is from very amateurish background. I've given this a title of St Kilda, a pioneering canoeist, and he really was a pioneer, a great adventurer. He was born on the 17th of October in 1844 in Brighton in England, and typical of that era, large families. He himself had a large family, and he was one of eight children himself. Brought up very much in a Christian household, quite a history of church within his own family, and of course he then himself had a calling to take up the ministry when he was in Australia. We've been able to, so far, do quite a bit of research into this fellow, and we know who his parents were, we know where he was born, we know the names of his children, where his children were born, some of whom were born in Victoria, and quite a bit of background in that regard. We also have found a journal, or I guess what we would call nowadays part of a journal. It's not a diary, it's just an attempt to by him to write a story, and one of the to illustrate this point about Brighton in England. I don't know if there's anyone in the room who's ever been to Brighton in England.
Yeah.
But it's right on the south coast, and not about anything. It's actually 50 miles from London. And we know that because of the London-Brighton car rally, which is a famous institution in England. And in this journal, FCV, as we effectively know him, says, "Brighton was my birthplace and the place where the first 15 years of my life were spent, a childhood sheltered, moulded and enriched by the influences of a Christian home. As I look back, to an eventful life and most varied experience, what are the objects and incidents which stand out mostly in the mind's eye? And he goes and he goes on to talk about his wonderful memory and memories of his time in his early years in Brighton. One of the other interesting things that comes out of his journey, and it's interesting the language that he uses, he uses the word, I now have to tell of great sorrow, for the angel of death entered our home. Terribly powerful language. And it transpires that in those days they had an enormous problem with scarlet fever, and he lost two sisters and one brother within weeks of each other, notwithstanding the fact that there were survivors of 8 children. So his home and his family background in Brighton in England, very much an English town on the coast. We had enormous difficulty in finding out what the Reverend Fay looked like. And this is what he looked like. You can almost sort of see him in the modern era. He would be John Blash or Schnell or perhaps Ernest Shackleton. He clearly saw himself as very much in the mould of an adventurer and of an explorer. The ministerial part came later. So there are few surviving pictures of him, but this is one. Interestingly, he grew up in Brighton, which is on the coast, and had a great longing for the sea. He just loved anything to do with ships, anything to do with going to the sea. And in his journal, he talks about this and how it influenced his life. And he says, "I now pass on to trace the links of the chain of influence which sent me to sea. What are the things which, under the providence of God, we are ever shaping our future? The books we read, the persons we meet, the things we do. I need hardly say that the books were not so numerous and so advanced 30 years ago as they are now, but I think they were more highly valued and better read. Cook's Voyages, Robinson Crusoe, did much to send me to sea." And they talked about a story in the boy's own paper about that really took him, about this boy his own age who ran away to sea. And in fact, on one occasion he was foolish enough to try and emulate this boy that ran away to sea. And actually got 5 miles along the Portsmouth Road. But with the approach of twilight, the many children tend to run away from home in those days. They approach when the sun sets, they have second thoughts, and back home they go for the punishment to be meted out, as you can imagine. And you've got to think of England back in that era of the sailing ships and all of that magic. It really was Britannia ruled the waves sort of era. And he says, "It is a singular trait which through all English history has sent England's sons to roam and rule the seas, giving the British Navy and the mercantile marine what they have been and what they are. Every person and thing connected with the sea is an absorbing interest for the lad whose great desire is for life on the ocean's wave." So he clearly had enormous desires to go off to sea at some point. And you can see how already we're starting to link his background and his love of the sea with his time in St Kilda, as I'll go on to demonstrate what he did when he came to St Kilda. So anyway, on the 12th of December 1859, he left home and entered to join the Royal Navy as a naval apprentice at Portsmouth, and it talks about him going onto the apprentice training vessel HM Ship Victory. Now, I'm not entirely clear as to whether that is the famous Victory, Nelson's flagship, which some of you may well have visited in Portsmouth, still in Portsmouth now, and if you ever do go to Portsmouth, I strongly recommend you do take a look at it. It's a fascinating visit to that. But anyway, off he went to sea.
It was a pretty hard life in those days. It was the days of the sealing vessels. They had the training. He went off and saw foreign service in many, many countries. He was as a young lad. After 2.5 years in the Royal Navy, he decided that he'd had enough of that and he would move on to the sea. I'm detecting in the little bit of research I've been able to do that he was someone that moved on quite quickly. Even when he came to Australia, he seems to have been a minister in a number of churches. He didn't stay long anyway. He didn't stay long in the Royal Navy, didn't stay long in the Merchant Navy. So it's a facet of his character that I've picked up. So he came back from the Royal Navy, back to England. I tried to settle into shore life, and as you can hear from the little bit I've read you already, absolutely futile. He saw himself as a sea-going guy, and his father trying to introduce him to the top field of one did in those days, Arthur Clark, and all of these sort of Gilbert Sullivan sounding jobs that he got in those days. Didn't work, so after getting some advice, he joined the Merchant Service, and I guess everybody knows the difference between the Royal Navy and the Merchant Marine. And during this time, interestingly, he lived through and witnessed and experienced, the transition from sail to iron vessels and steamships. And you don't hear about many people who have recorded that sort of stuff. I again saw a lot of foreign service. Visited and stayed in the Philippines, Chile, New Zealand, even Australia. Came all the way out to Australia to Queensland in those days. So he spent 6.5 years of his early life at sea. Then an interesting thing happened, and I don't know why he did it. He migrated to South America. Why would he migrate to South America? In those days, I'm not sure. It wasn't somewhere where people went off to the tea plantation zone of the Caribbean or something. He went to South America. In fact, I think it was Chile he went to, but I'm not entirely sure.
They could well have been. Well, perhaps I've fallen into the trap of actually saying more than that. I didn't realise that you were allowed to make it more flowery. I've made my first mistake as an amateur.
Anyway, in 1876, I think this is the terminology when someone hears a voice that says, "I want you to preach the word of God," and so on, and so he receives a call. And I don't quite know how again, there's a bit of a challenge in all of this, but he migrated to Cuba for ministerial training. And I know there are still ministerial training colleges linked to Monash University along Wellington Road, but I don't know whether an early version of those existed in those days or not. So why did he come, why to Cuba for ministerial training, I don't know.
Was he still in South America then?
No, I think he'd gone back to England, but don't know. There's a lot of gaps. He was receiving training in what was known then as the Congregationalist Church. And I understand that there's quite a bit of history about that you guys have researched, the churches in Cuba and where they were and the different denominations and so on. Well, there's one called the Congregationalist Church, and they, in latter years,
merged or united with the, became the Uniting Church of Australia, I think. The Congregationalists and some Methodists.
And
some Presbyterians, as opposed to the continuing Presbyterians.
Yes.
And so that was the church that he was linked with. And in my investigation, if I'm not to use the word research there, into FCD, I found this fellow called Dr. Peter Munster. I don't know if anyone here knows Dr. Peter Munster, but Dr. Peter Munster is historian, or and it is very, very much an honorary position, for Victorian Congregationalist Church. And he has already taken quite a bit of interest in this, as indeed has Dr. Reverend Ian Brewer of the Uniting Church Archivist Office, and who got his team onto it, and in fact in one of their newsletters has already talked about you, man, the Reverend S.C.D., and they were thrilled to bits that they could actually do something that was live and real, as archivists weren't doing that sort of thing. So after he migrated to St. Kilda for ministerial training, he obviously had an interest in young women, and they found one that was prepared to marry him. And this lady was named Frances Mary Allen. And they married on the 12th of December, and we know that they were married in Windsor, which seems to have been from what I think you call East Kilda, or that sort of area, and there's a bit of information about her too, so that branch is available to take a look at. I went on to have 8 children. Seems to be a popular number in the Fred Fairy family. So during this period of time that he was receiving this ministerial training in Tula, he came up with this idea that, and in those days, for some reason, the Congregationalists were spread around the bay a bit. They went just here in St. Kilda, and he wanted to minister to his flock. And as I say, they were everywhere. And so he came up with this idea that linked back to what I've been saying about his interest in the sea and his love of the sea and all of that sort of thing, and indeed his adventure training and his seamanship training, that he came across this idea that he would get himself a boat, and he would take his Bible and he would get on our Port Phillip, very close link with St. Kilda, and I see there you have a book about the naming of St. Kilda. He decided that he would go off and minister to his flock while he was here. And he says about this: in 1876 I resided as a congregational minister in St. Kilda, a suburb of Melbourne. One day I had been reading with great interest the travels of Mr. John McGregor in his Raw Boy canoe. Now John McGregor, just to divert from Fred Fairy for a moment, was a London-based Scot, and he was a patent lawyer, very rich, very well-to-do, the Victorian sort of thing, and he was a great adventurer. He went off paddling the rivers, the big rivers of Europe, continental Europe, the Rhine, the Rhone, and all of those rivers, and wrote extensively about them, and there's quite a bit of history written about this man, John McGregor, who as time has gone on has been recognised more and more for the great achievements that he did. And so Fred Fairy gone on to this John McGregor, this is a guy that can help me. So he, as a result of this thought, he wrote to John McGregor, and then he ended up then ordering this canoe from Sales in front of London. We know all this. In fact, we know that there is an original of this canoe in the Maritime Museum of London in Greenwich.
All these links are coming out of St Kilda and back to these other places.
But in fact, there are replicas of this in other places too. And I've seen one in the Royal Canoe Club in Kent. But the real one to see, if you're ever in London, is in the Maritime Museum down in Greenwich. So he says, and he uses a very flowery Victorian style of language when he's trying to convince himself to do something. And he refers to his flock down the western shores of Port Phillip, quote, "who seldom hear the gospel preached or see the faith of a Christian minister." Now he was only training as a minister at this point, but you can already see he had quite grandiose ideas of, he was, I think, Meyer, you made the comment of a character, and the more I read about this man, the more I can see he was a real character. So this crew arrived at his house in St Kilda on the 25th of June 1877, here in Melbourne, this is. And this is what it looked like, and I found this, I received this illustration by an interesting means. I decided that, well, why not try and find out if there's any of his descendants now living in Australia? And so I looked up the name Fairy of the internet white pages, and I wrote to every family by the name of that name, who was in South Australia, Tasmania, New South Wales, and Victoria. It's not such a big task to find. I think there was maybe about 30 letters. I'm simply saying to them, are you connected with this man? And out of that has come quite a bit of interest from people in Tasmania. By the way, I chose those states because he actually went to different churches in those states. He didn't just stay in Victoria, he preached in other places as well. And we found two living descendants, one in New South Wales and one in Tasmania, and one of them was able to produce this photograph taken in London of the canoe that he used for this journey.
Neither of
those gentlemen
is me.
Neither of
those,
no. That's
where they
told them. Yeah, where they told them. That's right, that's correct.
Yeah.
So this canoe arrived in St Kilda. Now, he was no canoeist. But that wasn't going to stop him. He was a very experienced seaman by this time. He knew all about the sea, and clearly to know all about the sea, he knew all about the weather, how to read the weather. He knew all about navigation. He knew all about all the things you learn as a naval apprentice, as he had been. And so he decided that the best thing to do would be to take this canoe on a maiden voyage. Let's go and see if it all works. Who can I visit? And so on. So he decided that his maiden voyage would be from here, would be from St Kilda. And I need to get my orientation right, but I guess everybody knows the St Kilda Pier in the Royal Melbourne Rocks Forum building. Well, he left from the location that would be now in right in front on the beach there. And he headed away towards Williamstown, what he used to call Stillmore, but Hobson Bay was the name of those days, and towards Egypt. And then he continued right down the west coast of Port Phillip. He had nothing kind to say about the west coast of Port Phillip at all, so nothing's changed much to today, really. Really, there's not very much there at all. We know because we had it down there. The interesting thing he did then is he worked out that he could carry his canoe over the road and go into the Barwon River at Geelong, which if you go on the road to Torquay, you cross that bridge and the Barwon River is underneath, and you can follow that river through a windy course and a series of lakes, and you reach Bass Strait at Barrowhead. Bass Strait, coming back through the Heads, Queenscliff, and back home again. So he decided he would do this. Now this was a major undertaking for someone that had never gone on such a journey, 100 nautical miles. So as you can imagine, everyone here probably thought he was nuts. And I don't have a pointer thing, Maya, but I'm trying to do my best here. Here we are up here from Sugar Hobson 3, so we're going here, then we'll be there, around Altona, down to the point 2, right down here, that's the Wellery River. Follow all this, that's all the two sheep plants now, down there, thank you. Follow all this stuff. Ah, thank you. What a wonderful. The Reverend Fred would be ready. Probably here for his particular welcome. This is all parkland area now. The jetty, there's a military jetty that's all allowed within 200 metres of it. And you continue through here and right down into Geelong. And when you reach Geelong, he put his kayak on a wee trolley and encouraged the local kids to wheel us over the road for him into the river. And he followed the rivers and the lakes over this here, the old lakeland, out to Barwon Heads. So he's now in Bass Strait. And he came along Bass Strait and back into part of the Heads on Lonsdale, which is the rip, Queenscliff, back up, round the Dillane Peninsula, which coincidentally this is where our historian that we found of the Peter Munster lives in this area here. Back out here and back to Melbourne again. A very successful maiden voyage. And he stayed with church people as he went and preached in the, and because in those days he went into someone's home and opened the Bible and did it what they did.
How long did it take him?
We think his diary is a bit inconclusive, but we think it would have taken him about a month. But he took his time. He wasn't in any hurry. He went to Geelong. He stayed with a minister in Geelong and stayed for a few days. But we think it took him about a month. It's a long way. I'd like to come back to that journey that he took in a wee while. But he then went on to serve the ministry in several other places. I'm not entirely convinced I've got that spelling of that name in South Australia correctly, so if there's any South Australians that can help me correct the spelling, that would be great. That's Stevenson? It's not spelled, I know it's not spelled the same way as the Victorian one, I do know that. He also served the ministry in Forth in Tasmania and in Windsor in New South Wales. Now, one of the great pieces of help that I have had is from a real historian, a researcher by the name of Carol Carruthers, who's the historian at the Hawkesbury Museum in New South Wales, Windsor, and because he actually lent his name to streets and suburbs in those places. He was very well known. The other interesting thing about him, whilst he did this maiden voyage here in Victoria, and that was importantly his first voyage, which is important for us here in Melbourne, we're going to grab the high ball ground here. Because when he went on to within Tasmania in the town called Forth, he did an even bigger trip. He actually, with the same canoe, followed the northern coastline of Tasmania, round to the east and from the eastern coastline all the way down to Hobart, which is pretty massive trip. So this guy really was a serious adventurer.
That's the point I'm making, that second dot point. Now,
I was made aware by Carol Carruthers, the historian, that some of his stories have been recorded in this publication, Boys Own Paper. Now, I don't know, is there anyone in this room has heard of Boys Own Paper?
Yeah.
You have, yet? Oh, through my friends at the back of Sea Kayakers. They're like you playing model sport. Boys Own Paper was brought out in the 19th century in London to try and stop the boys of the day reading what they called penny dreadfuls, some inappropriate comics as we would call them in those days. So somebody thought they would bring out something that was much more wholesome for the boys, more full of adventure stuff and all that sort of thing. And the FDDF decided that he would publish it. That was all we knew. We didn't know anything else, and I contacted the British Library and a whole raft of different places to try and find where I could get a hold of these publications of these adventures, of these canoe adventures of Fred Bailey. And would you believe, after all this seeking information primarily from the UK, I found a copy here in Melbourne in the Monash University Rare Books Library. All the way around the world, I was sitting here, it's the only one I've been able to find. What happened is the Boys Own Paper is that most of us will probably remember that a magazine or a comic would come out and they would bring out an annual version, Christmas time usually, to give it to your children as a Christmas present. And these stories of FCDs are published in the version in 1881 and 1882. And I've actually had this in my hand, and I have four copies of it. So I've been able to, in fact, access all of these stories written in the Boys Own Annual. And he talks in detail about his maiden voyage in Victoria. But not enough detail, interestingly, for your question to tell you exactly how long he took to do it. But detail nonetheless.
How good's your level?
I wondered as I need to throw the challenge back to someone here. Did you have a go?
No.
I can't even quite read it.
Fury,
Norway, Farago, the Delhi.
Is it? I forget the
sentence. There you go.
Well done. Get the sentence. So I then had a look at what can we learn about this man and that kind of thing. And so with this wonderful thing called the internet, you can now, of course, do all the genealogy type of research, which I'm sure everyone in this room has been involved in. And so I not only knew their eight children, but I knew their names, when they were born, and where they were born. And then I could see they were fairly prolific producers of children from South Australia, Tasmania, New South Wales, and in one case, a place called Home Cottage. It's another part of the challenge for you. East St Kilda.
That was probably the little hospital.
Really?
No, I don't know.
Uh-huh.
Take it right.
Uh-huh.
There are lots of little private hospitals. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Now, I mentioned earlier that we managed to find two descendants. The two descendants that we found are descendants of Kenneth and of Leslie. The descendants of Kenneth
still was in Northern, and he still is, he lived in Hughes, Wales, in Sydney, and the descendants of Leslie live in Tasmania. And the descendants of the Tasmanian ones in particular have taken a real keen interest in this ancestor of theirs, and they produce material and are interested in talking to people about who may be able to learn more later.
Four boys and four girls in 10 years.
So you're
going to get
the adventure
too.
He's probably
eager to
get it. Yes.
Imagine if you had been up on
Noah's place. Yeah, well, where that came from.
Now, this is the only photograph that I've been able to find of the Reverend in his ecclesiastical garb. And this came to me through this man, Paul Turvey. And one of the things I mentioned, Carol Carruthers, the historian, I'd say, the museum in New South Wales. Between Carol and I, we have succeeded in interviewing, recording the interview, so you can get a copy of this, of Carol's interview with the 81-year-old father. And so he would have been the grandson of the Reverend. We have yet to interview the other 81-year-old who's up in New South Wales, but that will happen.
Have they ever met each other?
No, not that we're aware of. But one of the things that we hoped to achieve one day, before you came in to the room, in Meyer's introduction, he talked about working with the local authority here. And I know that you're no stranger to local authorities, about doing something to permanently remember this man. And if we can bring that event about, what Carol and I have talked about is bringing those families together here in Melbourne. In other words, St Kilda becomes the catalyst for making all this happen before the Tasmanians and the New South Welshmen try and steal it all away from us. Not that I'm competitive. To move to the end of his life, he died on the last day of December in 1924 at a place called Kenty in New South Wales. And what we do know is that he's buried in Rookwood Cemetery. I don't know if that's any known to any of you. And interestingly enough, there is no headstone on the grave, it's marked simply by a rose bush. And this is a portion of his death certificate. And like all of these things, are never easy to read, but it looks like he died from myocardial irregularities. I think nowadays we call that after that.
Yeah.
Is that right? So that's another piece of information that we saw, that we have these documents.
Did you find out when his wife died?
No, I don't know. But that's another good question. That just it didn't dawn on me to think that way. I've never done this before.
Well, I've been watching. Who do you think you are?
I see. So right.
I know.
Yeah,
I know
yeah,
a lot about you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wonderful stuff.
So that's a bit of a snapshot into the life of SCD, and hopefully you can see why this character was of interest to those of us in the Victoria Sea Kayak Club. And as it so happened, last year was 140th year since he did this voyage here from St Kilda. So we decided that we would reenact his voyage, and his family, his descendants, took great interest in the fact that we were going to do this. And And so we decided that we would do exactly what he did, because you can actually follow his route quite well, the timing not perfectly, but we have to do our own timing in any event, because we all work for a living, we can't just sort of go off for a month around Port Phillip. And so we went on the same journey that he did, we did it over three stages of three weekends. That's a great question, because he did it the worst possible time of the year. He did it in the coldest time of the year.
And the
water temperature in Port Phillip would have been about 11 degrees, maybe 12 degrees at best. And he was a Victorian gentleman, so they wore their tweeds, and they didn't have the modern sort of gear that we have nowadays of thermals and all this stuff. So he camped out at the coldest time of the year. I guess he was in a hurry, because the canoe had arrived, so off he went. But what we did is we didn't know exactly where he camped. He didn't actually ever see where he camped. He said what he stayed, where he's in the town, I stayed in Geelong, or I stayed in Painted Head, or wherever it might be, but he never actually said where he camped, and he camped a lot. But what we decided to do, largely for just because it's capable of being done in a day and convenience and so on, is that we started here, exactly the same place as we said we needed, and we followed around Boston Bay, Williamstown, Altona, and we stayed the night at Werribee River. So that's as much as we're capable of doing the day, generally. And the next day, because all of this area, right down here, is totally debarred from access. You can't camp on a patrol, so there's no public access to it. Although I will admit, we sort of land on the beach and have a dog tea. So the next day we had to bypass all